Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. It's my pleasure today to be talking to John Irving, the author most recently of A Widow for 1 Year. I will go through the list in order. His first novel was Setting Free the Bears, followed by The Water Method Man, The 158-Pound Marriage, The World According to Garp, The Hotel New Hampshire, Cider House Rules, A Prayer for Owen Meany, A Son of the Circus, The Collection Trying to Save Piggy Sneed, and now A Widow for 1 Year from Random House. Now, this seems to me to be the apotheosis of your love for the big, well-plotted novel. And could you express that affection to begin with?
Yes, I think it's the best built, speaking as the builder, speaking as the architect. I think it's the best made of the last four books, each one of which I think is itself better made than any of the first five. But A Widow for 1 Year came with a structure that was more precise than any structure I've had in a novel ever. The structure simply being almost that of a play. It's a book in three acts from three different periods of time in a woman's life, chosen deliberately to be the three most difficult periods of this woman's life. The summer she's 4 years old and her mother leaves, and she doesn't see her mother again for 37 years. The fall, many years later, when she's a 36-year-old, successful novelist, but entirely less successful in her personal life, distrusting her judgment in men for good reason, especially. And last, the fall 5 years later, when she's a widow, age 41, with a child, a four-year-old boy, no coincidence, the same age she was when her mother left her. So the book came with this symmetry of vulnerability, really. Catch the character at the three most vulnerable periods of time in her life, and try to make a summation of who she is from those three short seasons, really: the summer of 1958, the fall of 1990, and last the fall of 1995.
Now, you seem to me to be the teller of indelible stories, and one of the interesting things about this book is that a visitor to Ruth's house in the middle years would see patches on the wall and picture hangers where pictures of her brothers used to hang. Each patch stands for a story, a moment of the story of these two now dead boys. And she goes about the house re-speculating about what picture used to hang there. Her mother has taken the pictures away. It's her. She's taken the pictures of the two boys, and the father has kept the daughter, Ruth. And it's the telling of these stories that has made Ruth a novelist, the supplanting of the missing with a story. I wonder what makes a story memorable for you, because you write the most complicated books, and yet readers, I think, putting down the books, can tell their stories to others. They are, you know, as I say, indelible.
I think you have to keep the emotional sympathy for the principal characters. You have to keep that sympathy as simple as you can make it. You have to know exactly which emotions that sympathy comes from and for which characters. For example, I wanted in the first part of this story for the absence of those boys who are missing, the dead children whom we never meet in their lives, I wanted their absence to be almost the principal character in the first third of the story. Certainly they are the most strongly felt presence. Their not being there makes everything happen that happens. It makes the husband the bad husband he is. It makes Marion the mother, the absent mother she will become. It makes her take a 16-year-old lover who reminds her of one of her dead boys. Everything that happens in this story comes from the loss of those boys. And Ruth, even before her mother abandons her, Ruth grows up in a house with the feeling that those dead boys are more important to both her parents than she'll ever be. It's in a book about loss, in a book about what's missing. I thought it was very important to begin with that. In the second two parts of the story, the mother, Marion herself, is the absence that's most keenly felt. And I felt very simply that the emotion in the book could not be complicated at all. I'm simply saying that if Marion, the mother, had ever come back into Ruth's life, even 1 year sooner than the 37 years she's away, I think in all probability Ruth would have rejected her. Ruth is very angry at her mother for not being there all the years she was growing up. But Ruth herself has to have a child of her own and lose a husband. She has to become the widow and the single parent of an only child in order to even fathom what a horrible life her mother has had. And it's Ruth's own recognition of how relatively little misfortune she's had that makes her realize that her mother has been handed a marked deck of cards.
Here, more than ever before, it seems to me, the characters have greater depth, I think, than in any of the previous novels, and merit standing next to some of the fictional antecedents that are in this novel. You quote a passage on marriage from Adam Bede, and there's a bit of Thackeray there. And none of these characters, I notice, they're not as readily divided between good and bad, between pure-spirited altruism and between and negativity. There seems to be a greater depth. Did they fill? Were you aware of that filling out as you told this story?
I was aware in this book's case of a narrowing, which I think makes these characters fuller, as you say. By narrowing, I mean it's a smaller cast of characters than I've dealt with in some time. It's the mother, the daughter, the father, the daughter. Those relationships are most important. The mother and her lover, there's that relationship. There's the portrait of the serial philanderer, who is also the children's book author, whose own children's books reflect some of his creepiness, his macabre obsession with things. Later, with young women in particular. Last but not least, it's always I always hold my breath when you introduce a major minor character two-thirds of the way into a story. It's against the rules. But last but not least, the Dutch policeman, who is an important
the detective
major minor character.
Can always arrive in the third act. You know that.
Yes, but you. When you've established that kind of narrative momentum that you must have 200 or 300 or 400 pages into a story, I always hate to slow it down even for 30 or 40 pages. But when you introduce somebody, that's what happens. It's like beginning a new book, and I come to those moments with trepidation, but I think I got through this one all right.
Well, it seemed to me that as much as I love, you know, adore the comic portraitures of Dickens, that here we are approaching the greater depth of character of George Eliot, say, that these are people who are being celebrated for their good and their bad. These characters are not like the narrator, say, of Bleak House, whose ultimate goodness becomes eventually improbable. It's an odd thing here. You've managed an entire cast of likable, unlikable characters. They're all horrible in their ways.
Except for the cop, I think.
Yes.
I think the cop has upheld his decency, perhaps the best. And Eddie, although he is deeply flawed as a writer, although he's doomed to a kind of minority as a novelist, and despite the haplessness of his teenage years, I mean, isn't everyone hapless as a 16-year-old, I think Eddie achieves a kind of a compassion that we're surprised by. I was a little surprised by it. I was surprised by how much I grew to like Eddie when for the first couple of hundred pages I had grown used to mocking him.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me that he, of all the characters in the book, earns the greatest prize. You know,
he's
the rewarded character.
Well, that's another thing I mean by however complicated the machinery of the story is, however many twists there are in the narrative, I believe that the emotion we feel for characters has to be direct and understandable, and I think that Marion, Ruth's mother, is the character who commands the most emotion. We can't help but sympathize with her. We can't help but love her and want her to come back, and to what degree is possible for her to be happy. And I knew I was sort of staking the emotional territory of the book on this character who, ironically, is missing for 37 years of the story. But I think for every year she's away, she grows stronger, and it makes her return all the more effective.
Now, it seems to me that the missing portraits of the two boys in part one, the missing mother for part two and much of part three, this is balanced by that question of a widow for 1 year. And yet that 1 year, that blank, that loss, seems to me to be an unexamined piece of the novel. How did the title come to appeal to you?
Well, I like the idea of a story that exists before and after a period of mourning, a period of seclusion. It's even an unsketched area of the book. We don't know what she did or who she was in the period that she took herself away. We have only a glimpse of the contained happiness of that marriage. We know that Ruth probably wasn't in love with her first husband, but we believe that she probably would have been married to him all their lives had it worked out, had he not died nonetheless. It was a happy marriage, if not in the conventional sense, a love marriage. And I wanted more than anything for the husband's absence in a book about absence to be all we get of that year. The idea that when she decides it's safe or at least acceptable for her to sort of go out in the world again, she should return to the very hotel where her husband died. And her four-year-old, in saying goodbye to the hotel, is wise enough to recognize that this amounts to saying goodbye to his father. This counts for the same thing.
Now, although there have been very powerful women in your previous fiction, this is the first one that has, in fact, two women as the central characters. And what's more, it seems that what you particularly know well is their areas of sexual fear. It seems to me to be particularly now a difficult thing for a novelist to pull off. What did you feel you had known in order to write them?
I think for a novelist, even today, and you're wise to single out today as the problem, I think for a novelist even today to be afraid of assuming the point of view of the other sex is a kind of giving in to what a non-fictional society we have become. The gender prioritizing in fiction now is really evil to me. The examples I give for this are very simple. If a novelist is any good, he or she has to be able to sort of get into the head of the other sex with the greatest amount of confidence that he or she ever has. I think in my lifetime I've known a half a dozen women who've committed adultery. But I always say that the adulteress I feel I know the best is Emma Bovary, who last time I looked was created by a man. I've certainly known a number of wronged women, women who've been led astray by the wrong sort of man. But I can't think of one I feel I know better than Anna Karenina, once again created by a man. I've even known a couple of dark, smoldering male lovers of the vengeful variety, but none as well as I know Heathcliff, created by a woman. I mean, it's I didn't blink to be in the point of view of either Ruth or Marion. I have written, I think, adequate major-minor women characters before. The thought of having the two principal characters of a novel both be women, the thought of this being a mother-daughter love story, that in the end, after albeit however much hardship, both the mother and the daughter have their love story. I felt perfectly comfortable in the hearts and minds of those two women. I think it was more of a stretch for me in The Cider House Rules to be in the point of view of an 80-year-old ether-addicted obstetrician, gynecologist, and abortionist. I've never been that. I think it was more of a stretch for me to be a granite quarrier and a body escort in the Vietnam War in the case of Owen Meany, and certainly a stretch to be an Indian-born orthopedic surgeon in A Son of the Circus. By comparison to imagining my way into a character, imagining my way into Marion's kind of sadness and Ruth's kind of anger was very easy for me to imagine.
I'm speaking to John Irving on the occasion of the publication of A Widow for 1 Year. This is Bookworm with Michael Silverblatt. Yes, and yet, it seems to me that Marion has been broken in a particular kind of way, that the depths of her despair as she's accepted a serially involved seductor as a husband, she takes on a retaliation, as later in the book her daughter does too. And in both cases, it's the retaliation and the pain of retaliation for both of them that seems to be so well understood. Both the breaking that leads to an action and the sorrow that leads, follows from the action seems to be what's known best and most intimately about these characters.
I'm glad you mentioned retaliation, because I think that that's only one area in which men and women remain different. In my experience, men take more satisfaction from retaliation than women do or can. It may fall into another area as well. When I first thought of this book, long before I thought I wanted Ruth to be a writer, or her father, a children's book writer, long before writing was a part of the story, the main character was always a woman because of the things she judged herself for. And one of the things Ruth judges herself for is an area of sexual misjudgment that men, frankly, most men, take for granted. Men are permitted to have a checkered sexual past. They can even tell funny stories about such a past, provided they don't repeat themselves too often, provided it really is a past and it's something that is behind them. If women have a sexual past, even today, I think they'd best keep it to themselves. They're judged more harshly for having had one, but most of all, they judge themselves more harshly for sexual errors, errors in judgment of that kind. If Ruth Cole were a man, A Widow for 1 Year wouldn't be much of a story. I think most of what happens to Ruth, most men, would psychologically shrug off. But women are in a different situation. The choice to make her, for example, past her mid-30s, unmarried, without a child, doubting whether she'd be a good mother or could be a wife, this is a familiar scenario, especially for women who, like Ruth, are successful in their careers. We could know a man who's been very successful in his career, who's had three wives, who has four children by three respective marriages, none of whom he's on speaking terms with. But the first thing out of our mouths about that man is about his career. We don't immediately sort of undermine his successes in his career by saying, yeah, well, he doesn't work out so well as a husband or a father. And yet still, even today, it's so often what we say, women included when I say we, it's so often the judgment that women make of themselves and of each other, that, well, she may be successful in her career, but she hasn't found that right partner yet. And as soon as she does, well, how often will she hear and how soon from her own mother, perhaps, well, when are you going to have that child now? These are areas of concern that haven't changed much. These are differences between men and women that seem to endure. Similarly, Ruth's anger that there's a whole territory of subject matter which, quoting Graham Greene, she looks upon as the sordid and the unseemly, which certainly was Greene material and has been the material of most male novelists of interests I can think of. At least we all have a book like that in us, where the territory of the unseemly and the sordid it's almost like a rite of passage for male novelists. Women novelists are perhaps treated better when they leave it alone, or they go to that subject with some trepidation. Had a man been in Ruth's situation in Amsterdam, paying a prostitute to hide in her closet to see the prostitute with the customer, I don't think most of us would be surprised to hear that a man did that once in his life, whether or not he was researching a novel or not. But for a woman to even be there is still scandalous. I was looking for things of that nature to suggest that it was no arbitrary or whimsical decision on my part to make my main character a woman. She's a woman for a reason.
It seems to me, and we've spoken a bit about this before, it's a very interesting subject to me, that while some of the most popular and well-remembered characters of yours are people who've taken an enormous risk and become, say, a transsexual, a prostitute, people who've gone over a border, that your most interesting characters, your central characters, are ones who, like Ruth, the heroine of A Widow for 1 Year, who stay on the threshold, who are not ready yet and wait a good deal of time before they give way to passion. It rather frightens them. And your characters who, I think, are centrally concerned in these narratives that are best known for their miscreants are the ones who fear to act because they are so loyal, are very respectful of the past, are very respectful of their families. These are conventionally good people who fear entering a world full of adventures that they don't want to have, it seems to me.
Yes. Well, recklessness may be interesting in action films and in other venues, but in truth, I think my admiration has always been for people who are careful. Of course, my admonition is that being careful is rarely going to keep you out of trouble for long. In other words, it's my job, it's my responsibility as a novelist to create a character who has those kind of concerns, but what happens to that character will happen to him or her in spite of who they are.
Well, it seems to bring us to the epigraph of the book. Thackeray is saying, "As for this little lady, the best thing I can wish her is a little misfortune," which to my mind seemed to be not too much misfortune, but enough to get her launched.
True.
That life doesn't begin until misfortune does.
No, certainly a good story, I think, can't long endure without a little misfortune. And the hope among one's characters is that there are people who survive their misfortunes, and then there are those whose misfortunes are too great to bear.
I've been speaking to John Irving. The occasion is the publication of A Widow for 1 Year from Random House. To my mind, this is my favorite John Irving book. You know, in a career full of favorites, it's the one that seems to me to be the most complicatedly modulated and oddly balanced of the flock, and thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance today from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's book. Off the mouse,
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.